The best podcast in baseball is brought to you by Closets by Design. Update your closet, garage, office, pantry, and more. Imagine your home totally organized with Closets by Design. Call 1-800-BY-DESIGN. That's 1-800-BY-DESIGN.
Welcome to a brand new best podcast in baseball. I'm joined this week by colleague and sports columnist Jeff Gordon. We're going to talk about the Cardinals' relentless bunch. That is the lineup and their leader and his catchphrases. Yes, we're going to talk a little Brant Brown. We're going to look at what a six-man rotation means for the pitching staff. And we're going to get into the attendance and ticket sales and whether or not the drop in ticket sales matches the drop in payroll and how the Cardinals can get it back. Is it a style of play that brings them back? Or is there something more afoot here in the sense that the Cardinals have said this is a transition year? So watching the team now, coming to the ballpark now, might just mean that you're watching a team that's dismantled by August. And where's the fun in that? Cue the music. Hello, everybody, and welcome to the best podcast in baseball, brought to you by Closets by Design of St. Louis. I'm St. Louis Post-Dispatch baseball writer Derek Gould, joined this week by our instant offense, our multimedia maven, our St. Louis Post-Dispatch, STLtoday.com sports columnist, and moonlighting hockey writer, Jeff Gordon. Gordo, how are you doing?
Well, good. And I was just lamenting for the Cardinals. The fact there are no overtime loss points in baseball really hurt the Cardinals. They would be they would have stacked up four of those, right? So those would come in handy in the standings. But no such thing in baseball. In hockey, you can get the loser point and keep moving toward the playoffs.
There is crying in baseball. There are no ties in baseball. That's the rule of thumb, right? All right. So, Jeff, who's had more hits in the past week? The Cardinals or the Blues?
Yeah, the Blues are they're a little bit they're a step off. They got to kind of get back to bulldozing. The way the Cardinals are playing right now, man, they've actually been the exciting team to follow here, right? The Blues are kind of hanging on and trying to get into the bracket like they ran out of steam. Cardinals just trying to gather some steam, and man, they are raking.
Yeah, they are. They started the season with 9 consecutive games of at least 10 hits. They're the first National League team to start a season that way. Only the 1990 Cleveland club that featured, you know, Hall of Famers like Jim Tomei and Roberto Alomar reached 10 consecutive games of at least 10 hits to begin a season. So, you know, that's a carved up esoteric trivia stat. It's fun, but it speaks to the fact that, you know, they did that while Nolan Arenado did not have a home run except for on opening day. They did that while Wilson Contreras was batting 100 and did not have a home run until he got a torpedo bat. They did that while guys were still – some of the key guys were still searching for their production. But they also did that while Brendan Donovan began a 10-game hitting streak that he has taken here into tax day, into Jackie Robinson Day at the ballpark. And during that time, he's hitting .513. I think, you know, what stands out to me, Jeff, is just the consistency of approach. I think this is a feistier offense. I don't think it's a more powerful offense than they've had in the past or that they've imagined they'd have in the past, but sure feels like a feistier offense.
Well, and you got guys setting a tempo in that top third of the batting order. You know, Lars Nootbaar is a competitive, tough at bat, and so is Brendan Donovan, right? So these guys, it's great to have tempo setters there. And just in general, everybody seems to be in a good place, a good vibe. You know, a lot of good talk about, you know, what's happening in the batting cage with the team of hitting coaches, the analysts, all the things that are going on. There's just a good feeling and there's a contagion that's a good one. Instead of a building frustration, you've got an offense that builds. And, you know, you just got a lot of guys who seem to be confident right now, feeling good about themselves. And, you know, oh by the way, everybody, let's use Brendan's bat because he was ahead of the curve, but he was at the curve on those on the torpedo.
On the bottle bat. Yeah, his isn't quite – it's interesting, like, just how much we're learning about bats, right? I go back to watching Paul Goldschmidt take batting practice and seeing, like, this knob on the end of his bat just a few swings in, and I asked him about it, and he goes, give me a couple days, and I'll talk to you about it. And he did. It was the first time he changed his bat ever in his career, and it was this counterbalance or puck bat. And one of the guys I spoke to about that, he said, you know, the next, all this focus on spin rates and pitch craft and all the things that pitchers can do because of these high motion capture or because of motion capture tech or high speed cameras, all these things that they can do. Well, it's time for the batters to catch up. And the place where that's going to take, you know, where that's going to happen is in the bat design and the technology of the design. And they thought at the time, and this is still true, that it was going to be personalizing bats based on like the best balance for the hitter. Not everybody gets through the swing the same way. Not everyone gets to their power contact the same way. So how do you do that? And they had all this different calculations that they would do and all this scanning that they would do, this motion capture that they would do. And they found that some guys could increase, which makes sense, the central force of their swing by with a counterbalance. Well, now we're seeing that like it's not just going from the handle, it's going up into the actual barrel, which makes sense. And how the sweet spot is maneuvered and shaped in the actual barrel. And that's the torpedo. Think of Brendan Donovan's bat as more of like a bottle, right? And the torpedo is more of a bowling pin, right? It tapers towards the end. And, you know, so you got Wilson Contreras with the torpedo bat, goes out, hits his first home run of the season. You got Brendan Donovan, who has been using the bottle bat for a little bit here. He's got a 10-game hitting streak with, 20 hits in that 10-game hitting streak, leads the league in hits. Then you have Nolan Arenado, who has three doubles in the past two games, two doubles and a home run in his game against the team that wanted him, the team that thought they traded for him, the team that thought they had him as their third baseman, the Houston Astros. And he's been one of the guys using the counterbalance bats. So, you know, there's something going on, obviously, with bats, and maybe that'll help the hitters catch up, but they probably still won't catch up to 97 sink from the left like the Cardinals saw from Christopher Sanchez.
Well, I think it harkens back to the day when Albert Bell was a bat engineer. You know, it was a little more crude. You know, the bat might explode. Things might come flying out of the bat. But
true story. Wait. True story. I was at that game of all craziness. Like, I have these serendipitous moments of when I was chasing baseball before I was a baseball writer. And that was in Chicago on the South Side. And I was at that game where that happened. I also happened to be fortunate to be at the game where Jim Edmonds with the Angels made that catch with the diving back to his home plate catch of all things. So I'll never forget being in the crowd as all that craziness with Albert Bell unspooled and watching it and explaining to one of my college buddies about what was going on. And I was like, I can't believe we're watching this crazy.
Well, my only moment like that was in basketball. I was there in Kansas City at the backup arena, the Memorial, when Daryl Dawkins blew up the backboard, famously.
Oh, nice.
Because the Kemper roof had caved in, and they were playing their games in downtown the old arena, and that thing had been in storage, and Double D would have none of it. So that was my claim to fame. But
no, all of us at the ballpark missed the biggest story of that Bell thing, which was the pitcher climbing through the vents.
Oh, that's awesome.
To then snag the bat so that there wasn't any evidence.
Yeah, the old it was impounded in the umpire's room, and they went up and got it. So yeah, back in the day in the old stadiums, you could do that sort of thing, right? So this is exciting about. There's so much innovation that goes on with hitting, obviously, trying to counter all the innovation that goes on with pitching. But, man, Derek, not as it all come down to it, but, boy, how much of it's just guys feeling good, guys confident, guys believing, guys being aggressive, to your earlier point, and just going up there, you know, not with reluctance. Like sometimes we seem to guys like Jordan Walker when he was struggling or Nolan Gorman when he was befuddled. And now these guys are confident.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of that starts in the cage. A lot of that starts with preparation. I'm glad that you mentioned like Jordan Walker, like he's coming to the plate with a lot more verve, a lot more like confidence. He's playing the outfield that same way. I think it's really interesting. I want to run you through a few things here, and then I got a game for us to play. Okay.
All right. So
in the past week, as we're recording this, the Cardinals are hosting the Houston Astros and closing out the homestand. They've won their past two games. They beat the Phillies in a series for the first time since 2017. They have a chance to beat the Astros for the first time in a series in even longer. That's partially because the Astros fled the National League for the American League, for the comfort of the American League West. You know, they got out of that harsh, terrible, unforgiving NL Central and went to the American League West. But in the past week, the Cardinals have beat these following pitchers, and these pitchers all took the loss in these games. They go by Paul Skeens, you've heard of him, Aaron Nola, Zach Wheeler, and Framber Valdez. All of them, except for Skeens, have October highlights in their career. All of them have been All-Stars. Three of them have been All-Stars in the past 2 years. Two of them were All-Stars this past year. Skeens, in his other games, he's allowed 2 runs in 12 and a third innings. To the Cardinals, they got him for 5 runs in 6 innings. Valdez had allowed only 5 runs all season. All of it came in one game. But he had only allowed, and he had 2 scoreless outings around the 5-run, you know, bruise. But the Cardinals get him for 10 hits and 7 runs. You know, that foursome has an ERA of 3.3, which is fine. I mean, you know, you probably look at that foursome and go, well, they'll probably have a group ERA of 2. 3.3 against everybody but the Cardinals. 7.3 against the Cardinals. The Cardinals' performance against Valdez, and I think they were somewhat geared up for Valdez by facing Sanchez, right? Both lefties, both sinker ballers. Sanchez comes with the heat, had a lot of movement. Valdez has a little less velocity. Cardinals were on him. They were able to lift him. They hit 5 doubles. You know, they were able to handle his sinker in a way that they could not handle Sanchez's. But there's a similarity there that they were tuned in for it. You know, his ERA, they added 2 runs to it in 4 innings. They are what Brendan Donovan told me, that they're the relentless bunch. They have been. And I think that's been something that they, because like you said, when you're feeling good, it's a little easier to continue what you have going than to cold start an offense. They don't have to cold start an offense.
Yeah. I like the tough at bats. And even when you look at going back to Jordan Walker, even if he's getting called out on a pitch that was not a strike, he was showing good plate discipline, you know, chasing far fewer pitches. He had, you know, he had a couple of nasty curveballs in the game on Monday for sure, but he just kept battling, came back, hit a rope for a ground rule double. But, you know, laying off pitches that he would have gone after, and it just guy after guy extending at bats, they're building up pitch counts. Sometimes they're ambushing a pitcher in a situation where they anticipate a chance to do so, but you know, just impressive. They're willing to just work and work. And it was not just, again, the more veteran hitters only recently joining the party. These guys from day one of the season, some of the younger hitters who are now maturing hitters, really very impressive with their approach.
I was struck by the second inning against Framber Valdez. Nolan Arenado leads off with a double. Brendan Donovan extends his hitting streak with a signal. Now you have no outs, runners on first and second. And this is exactly the situational hitting that Brant Brown has talked so much about. They spent so much time in spring training discussing, and they felt they failed at so often last season, which is runner on third, less than 2 outs, get the run in. All right. And what happened? 2 strikeouts, 3 up, 3 down. Nolan Arenado never budges from third. Brendan Donovan never budges from second. And Valdez escapes. Last year, that's it. That is probably over. They have their gasp and they don't come through and they wilt. This team just kept pressing. And I thought that was really interesting. And that's one of the things that Brant Brown talks about, is like innings don't spill into other innings, whether they're great innings or they're not great innings. You're not building a snowball inning to inning to inning, counting on the avalanche. You're starting with a fresh snowball at the beginning of every inning. And so look at it that way. Don't count on momentum from one inning to the next carrying over. If it does, fine, great. But don't count on that. And also don't say, well, we got 3 in the last inning, so this is an inning where we can get by. No, get 3 more. It's a little bit like what Tony La Russa talked about, like, you know, what made Albert Pujols great was this notion that he was 3 for 3 and he didn't call it a day. He was hungry for 4. And remember, Tony kept calling him what, a hungry hitter? No, a greedy hitter. That's what he called him, a greedy hitter. He's a greedy hitter. He wants his hits, greedy hitter. And, you know, so in a way, like, you get to be a greedy offense, right? And you see the Cardinals doing that where, you know, they were up, you know, they got a shutout going. Their pitching was really going well. Pick a day, either Libertor's day or Sonny Gray's day, and they got a nice lead. Then they add on. So I think in a way, like, you know, they call themselves relentless, but Tony La Russa would call them greedy. They've been greedy with hitting.
Yeah, they go back to the dugout between, you know, hitters go back. What'd you see? What'd you do? A lot of discussion, a lot of good vibe, a lot of communication within the group. Guys feeding off each other, celebrating hits, but also talking about, you know, the outs that occurred. What do you see? What's happening out there? How do we adjust? And, you know, last year, just so much exasperation all year. And this year, just such a different vibe. Now, this can change if a team goes into a collective slump.
True.
But while this thing is feeding, you have guys who are really getting – really establishing themselves this year. And, again, this was a big year for – something I'm going to write about for the paper tomorrow and online tomorrow is that, you know, this was such a big year for so many of these position players who have shown that they can play. Some of them took a step back last year. They're all at that point where who are they? And they're starting to make that claim, like, you know, this is who I am.
Right.
This is the player I am, and this is the level I think I can be at the rest of my career and maybe even be better.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And that's what this whole year the Cardinals say is about. We'll see if their performance starts to change. Are you ready to play a game, Gordo? Are you ready?
I'm not very good at games, so you'll probably make me look silly.
Nope. I if anything, it will make us both look silly. How well do you speak Brant Brown? All right, I'm going to give you some of the phrases that the Cardinals' new hitting coach, Brant Brown, who they hired from Seattle, a former Cubs. Some folks may remember him as playing for the Cubs. But he brought a lot of energy right from the get-go. He's very enthusiastic. He's a lot for the hitters. But he has found ways this is kind of his approach. This is true other places and is now true with the Cardinals, where he tries to come up with phrases, sayings, things like that, some of them on the spot, that resonate with guys and simplify. He doesn't want to inundate with a whole lot of information. He'd rather latch them onto something that they can repeat. And we're starting to hear it in the players' quotes. So something that Brant Brown might have said, you know, in the second week of March is now you're seeing it pollinated in all the quotes from the players. So anyway, you ready to play? Here, sure. Let's see if you can translate Brant Brown. All right. There's a time to slug and a time to hit.
That almost sounds like a song, you know.
It does. It's from the band Nolan Arenado and the Relentless Bunch.
Yeah, I think when you again talk about situational hitting, right? And you know, there's a Stephen Piscotty used to say there are times to go big, to go. He was more of a measured hitter, and there were times that he would try to load up and hit for power, which is not his normal approach to hitting. But there were times to go for it. So yeah, game situations. There are times. You know, when you just need to get that runner in or that runner over, you're not slugging. You're trying to make sure you do your job. But there are chances in a game where you could pop the game open and you feel it with the pitcher. You think you know what you got.
Mm-hmm.
Slug.
And then he's also talking about within counts, too, when you have an advantage count and you have a defensive count. There's a moment in a bat to slug, to look for the pitch that you can drive and drive a long way. And then there are times when you're behind in the count and you got to be defensive and you need to hit. You need to provide. All right. What is a hit collector?
Well, just somebody just finds a way at the plate. You know, you're finding a way to just at bat to, you know, that consistency.
Close. He's referring to hitters like Luis Arraez and some of the guys who are out there just kind of bulk hit collecting. They're not guys who are going to drive the ball. They're not guys who are going to have a high slugging percentage or chase a high slugging percentage. They're not the run producers. They're the get on base and score the run guys. And the best way to do that is to collect a lot of hits. It's what he's been calling Victor Scott II. He said, you're a hit collector. Go collect hits. Go get a bunch of them however you can. And how that's manifesting is every so often you'll see Victor Scott say, you're going to give me a hit with a bunt. I'm going to take the bunt because I'm collecting hits and that's what I'm going to do. And it's one of the things that Brant Brown told him. He's like, I don't remember a hitter ever going home angry. They were 2-for-4 and no one asked, were they both bunts? If they were giving them to you, take them, go take them. And even like he told me what the batting average was for bunts, you know, so, and he was able to tell, tell Victor Scott that and say, look, this is going to work to your benefit more often than not. So, all right. And we'll,
I got one. Just quick, is Brendan Donovan a hit collector? Because he does not have the big exit velocities, yet he finds a way.
Yeah, yeah, he would count. He takes his walks, though, too. So that's part of it. But, yeah, he would count as a hit collector. I think they'd like to see a little bit more doubles from Brendan, right? You know, like that kind of swing. But, yeah, he'd be a hit collector, too. All of these phrases come from the – here's a plug – the new newsletter that I'm writing this year. Every Friday in your inbox, this past Friday, was the Brant Brown Dictionary of Phrases. So I offered it up to readers of our new newsletter. You can sign up for it at stltoday.com. It's called The Right Fielder. That is W-R-I-T-E. Get it, Gordo?
Yep, yep. Okay. We ran this by. We did a trademark run on this. And
we did.
Good call.
All right. It's working out. We'll see. I think it has 12 readers, so it's great. We're doing well. So 12 people out there can speak Brant Brown. Okay, here's another one. Ready? All right. Take care of the point. That's a phrase that Brant says a lot to those. Take care of the point.
Now, that one doesn't resonate with me. Then again, I was a very poor hitter at the organized level, which is why I quickly got out of baseball.
I will give you a hint. In the second inning that we discussed here earlier against Framber Valdez, the Cardinals did not take care of the point.
That is, did not get the run?
Get the run. They did not get in the run from third with less than two outs. When they have a runner at third and less than two outs, you'll hear Brant Brown talking about take care of the point, take care of the point. Sometimes he'll sub in point for runs when he's talking to guys. So, you know, another example of like more on a one-to-one level is you had Brendan Donovan in the on-deck circle, and he was about to face one of the Twins pitchers. And Brant Brown said, look, this guy's going to play a game. He's going to play a game with you, and he's going to go cutter, changeup, cutter, changeup, cutter, changeup. And then he will probably, if he gets that far in the count, he'll go, you know, on that fifth pitch, he'll try for a front hip sinker. And he said, so watch the game, watch the game. Don't play his game. And so Brendan Donovan went up there, and he goes, okay, first pitch cutter. Oh, huh. Second pitch changeup. Oh, huh. Now I know what's coming. Third pitch cutter. Fourth pitch changeup. He goes, all right, well, here comes the front hip sinker, and he put a sacrifice fly in play. So he was like, how did Brant do that? And it was like just a brief thing, but he distilled down the scouting report. He told him, you know, he gave him the lingo. He's going to play a game, watch him seesaw, you know, whatever, you know, it was like, watch for this game and don't let him play it. And sure, it played out. All right, here, two more for you, Gordo. Bunting is like real estate, location, location, location.
Well, sure. That's obviously for, you know, Victor, as well as he can run if he doesn't place the ball correctly. And this will depend on also, you know, who's pitching in addition to how the infield is set up. But yeah, just, you know, putting it where you have to, you know, and then mastering the skill of putting that ball where you have to, you know. And Victor's got a little more margin for error than most guys. But yeah, just placement.
Placement. Yep. And if you place it in the right spot, you got to hit. Actually, I lied. I have two more from here. Nibbler.
Oh, that would be the pitcher that's just always working the edges, always, you know, just, never coming right at you, never challenging, just sort of.
Yep.
Yeah, and, you know, Sonny Gray could be a bit of a nibbler.
He can be. In fact, that's probably – Brant Brown would probably give that actually, he probably would call him spin. He would probably call him – he would talk about his spin. But, you know, nibblers, and then, of course, you know, there are other descriptions for guys who just bring heat, like a Rodri Munoz, who everything is just high velocity. There would be another description for him. Okay, last one. Here we go. This all matters in the tournament.
Oh, well, I would imagine just you're trying to get to the postseason, and that's what all, you know, that's where you're trying to get, and you're trying to play the type of baseball that'll get you there.
He's actually talking about the type of baseball that wins in the postseason.
Okay.
All right. Practice now for the type of baseball that wins in the tournament. It's an interesting kind of notion, right? Like one of the things that it conveys is that over the course of 162, there are going to be times where this doesn't win you the game, right? But still practice it. Like, practice this to get better at it, to execute it, to know what you're doing in the situation, because that's what's going to win you a game in the tournament. That's where it comes from.
I'm going to throw one back at you that I've been hearing a lot on the hockey side. You know, well, you know, we've just been too results driven.
Oh, and, yeah. Yeah. Not process driven.
Yeah. It's just like same the coaches in every sport, managers always talk about the process, sticking to the process, doing what you have to do. Over time, the results will be there. The Blues kind of got away from that, looking at the standings, looking at who was, you know, where the Flames, what they were doing, how many points they needed, so on and so forth, who they might play in the playoffs. They've kind of lost track of the process. So
Monty's
got a bunch of those himself. So
yeah, I would imagine. Yeah, I got the chance to talk to him a few times. I only messed up and asked him a baseball question once.
I asked him
about innings when I meant ice time. I thought that was fair.
Bounce back with Monty by throwing some hair metal questions at him, because he's definitely a man of that ilk.
Oh, okay. Shoot, I would have known that. I could have told him how I've accidentally been to so many Cheap Trick concerts. Like, I didn't mean to go to any of them, but I've been to a whole bunch of them. Like, I just kept like, hey, you want to go see a concert? And like, sure, yeah, that sounds great for tonight. We'll go to the House of Blues in New Orleans. Who's playing? Cheap Trick. Oh, yeah. All right. All right. That's cool.
I want you to want me. Again.
They want me to see them, apparently. Yeah. Yeah. So are you – where's your level of confidence with this lineup? They seem to have, you know, all right, 16 games in, they're .500, they're cranking out the hits. They are – speaking of Cheap Trick, they are doing – I mean, they're doing well. It seems like they have a real good feel for – an identity. They have what we call proof of concept, you know, where they're getting results. Like you say, it's a lot easier to believe in the process when you see immediate results, and that can build. It seems like where last year's team was constantly trying to grope for any sort of semblance of offensive consistency or offensive identity, this team has it and is rolling downhill with it. Are you believe they're going to hit their bumps? They're going to hit their speed bumps. They're going to hit their uphill climb, but they're going to have momentum going into it. That seems to be a good thing.
Yeah. They got a lot of guys that are, you know, this is an interesting bunch in the sense that they've, you know, you've taken some hits. Mason Wynn's got to sit down for a bit with his back. Early on, Nolan Gorman strains a hamstring. These are minor situations. Ivan Herrera more serious after his fast start. And then you talk about the slow starts for Nolan and for Wilson. And now you're seeing that potentially if all of these guys are together and most of them are doing what they can do, which is a reasonable expectation, I think. You're never going to have everybody all going all at once. But there's so much you can do with this group, and to the point where it becomes a challenge for Ollie, and it's a juggle because you've got options. So, I, you know, going forward, how do you get the at-bats for Gorman? If Arenado's still here, how do you make sure Herrera gets enough at-bats when you got a guy behind the plate who's really good at handling pitchers and who can throw out a runner? And he's also a competitive hitter as your other option. I mean, there's so many things with this group, but you know what you have in the top, you know what you have at the bottom, you know what you have in the middle. And even though there's some interchangeability left and right, you know, you're good there. You've got balance. There's really not a weak hitter in the bunch. Baker's proving that he can be an effective part-time hitter against lefties. You like the group, and you like to think, okay, this is not an aberration, because you're missing guys and you've had some slumps, and yet the results speak for themselves.
Alec Burleson probably ought to play more. You know, I mean, he's playing a lot, but I imagine as this kind of unfolds, you'll see him against lefties more often, certainly a style of lefty. They had Nolan Gorman start against Valdez, 'cause you know, he can get a guy, you know, he can kind of lift a guy. Whereas Alec Burleson contact, put that sinker in play. You know, you might see Alec Burleson against some of the higher velocity lefties, someone maybe at the top of the zone where Burleson can drive the pitch. So I think it'll be interesting to see how that evolves. But you know, there's another young hitter who is defining exactly what you're describing, kind of showing who they are as a hitter in the early stages. And I think there's growth potential for him with playing time. The lineup has done its part. Matthew Liberatore and Sonny Gray over the past few days have done their part. They haven't allowed a run in any of their innings. They've got back-to-back quality starts for the first time this year. Sonny Gray joins Andre Pallante as the two pitchers who have gone seven innings. We're seeing the Cardinals approach with Miles Michaelis, which is not letting him go a third time through the lineup, which is something that leaves innings elsewhere for folks to handle. So that's something to watch. And then we're on the brink of the Cardinals going to New York, which means on the eve of that series in Queens, Steven Matz, the former Mets, will join the rotation as the sixth man. He's got the start for the final game of the homestand. The Cardinals outlined this in spring training. They gave us the reason for it. They said he's ready to go. He'll be around that 65-70 pitch range when he goes, so they'll have to have length behind him, possibly. But, Gordo, are you a believer in the six-man rotation, or do you feel it's something of a backup quarterback scenario where if you have six starters, you don't have five?
Yeah, well, I think this team has, like, realistically, four number five starters, and this is kind of what you get. But my concern would be, I think this is a part of the modern game, and I get the idea that, you know, Eric Fetty wore out.
You mean consecutive games, like playing a baseball game every day is part of the modern game? Is that what?
Yeah, no,
it's a new addition to the schedule. Everybody, we're playing a game every day.
It's that more teams are looking for a six man rotation, or we'll even see, I'm sure, more piggybacking as we go forward. We've seen the opener fad come through. So I look at this group. I get it, why you would do it. You want Sonny Gray to be good all the way through the season. You want him to be strong. You want Eric Fetty to stay strong. Last year he did fade a bit. You're trying to – Pallante is still a guy who you're building. Liberatore is still a guy you're building. Okay, so it makes sense. That part makes sense. What doesn't make sense is, and how do you deal with the fact that of these six – two of them are pretty likely to be guys you don't want to go through a third time through the rotation, through the batting order with. So where is your length in the bullpen to account for having two of your six guys, I'm skeptical, are going to be able to work deep?
Yeah, that's where Rodri Munoz has to come in. That's where Kyle Leahy comes in. But if Kyle Leahy is providing innings, then Kyle Leahy's not the setup guy. So you got to have somebody else who can do that. Chris Roycroft is in AAA. They were looking to him to do that. They've replaced him with Munoz, who's a length guy. So you can see how, you know, the bullpen may not have the pieces in place. Though, you know, Phil Maton being a setup guy and being, you know, that one inning guy, that does help lead into Helsley. I think it's really telling that the Cardinals feel they need to go to a sixth man rotation in the majors because they're concerned about their depth of pitching in the minors. That's a big part of this, is the fact that if they lose a starter, say they go, all right, well, this is just going to be a long haul, and they know the data is that the injuries are, they tilt towards April coming out of spring training as adrenaline and full speed games and just the slog of the season begins and pitchers get into it. And you see it all throughout the game. You know, April tends to be a rocky and challenging month and tends to be, of all the months, the outlier for injuries. The Cardinals are trying to navigate that, knowing that they can't avoid all injuries, but they feel like they can at least set up a schedule that doesn't invite them. And this is their answer to that, because Drew Rahm is injured, because Zach Thompson is injured, and because they're like, well, if we lose a starter from the rotation, then you call on Michael McGreevy, and that's about where you feel comfortable. And so they're like, you got to do everything possible to keep the six starters that they have going. And then McGreevy sort of serves as the seventh guy, and you allow his performance to elbow somebody aside.
Yeah, he would be your option if you just at some point just want another long guy in the bullpen to be a piggyback. But yeah, it doesn't help. You know, Quinn Matthews, a lot of hope for him. He ends up with a sore shoulder. Be interesting to see where that goes. He survived college somehow, being used to the beyond the point of abuse.
Yeah,
and, they need him to. They need his progression to continue. So you watch that. Tinkhead's absolutely cannot stay healthy. I'm not sure he's physically built to play baseball, at least to be a starting pitcher. You know, once again, he misses a big chunk. So not that he would have been a big answer until maybe very late in the year this year. So really, your depth is still something that you've got to address developmentally, and it's nowhere near where you need to be. You tried to acquire a bunch of depth last year. You know, or previously with the bailout trades, you know, but then again, like you mentioned, Rom gets hurt and he was a big part of your depth piece. And you just, yeah, it's, they're in a tough spot. You know, I really wonder how they can get through this stretch. Again, with the bullpen being where it is, my weekly complaint to anybody in my chat or anywhere in writing is that that's still unresolved, and we've seen some shuffling with the bullpen, but particularly lengthen the bullpen now. Let's see what they do.
Yeah, I think it's something to watch. You know, the if there's a they need either some sort of outside addition to the pitching staff, which we don't know if they have the stomach or interest for. They're going to need that, or they need lightning to strike in a surprise way. That could be McGreevy, who's pitched well enough to be that guy, but is he able to do that for 12 starts? Is he able to do that for 15 starts? That could be Graceffo. Is he ready to suddenly have impact in the bullpen? Is he the guy who could do that? Is it Roycroft returning? You know, or is it a guy who is just outside the kind of radius of the roster, though he's on the 40 man, and he surges in, and that's Tekoa Roby, and they can't ignore him. You know, back-to-back four-inning shutout appearances for him at Double-A. Double-A is at least on the doorstep of the majors, another guy who they want to see pitch consistently to prove his health. He feels in a better spot physically with his routine, with his regimen, with his proactive care than he's ever been, and he just might have the best fastball in the organization beneath the majors. So we'll see, you know, but I don't know if the Cardinals are in a spot where, because this is their quote unquote reset, quote unquote transition year, where they let this evolve, or if they get to a point where they're like, no, you know what? This team needs help. It's playing well enough and we can reshape the look of it, or at least give it a, you know, give it a buoy by adding pitching. I think that's really something to watch unfold. We talked about the offense. There's a lot of excitement in the style of offense. We'll see if that generates fans there. We'll see if it generates wins. This division is vulnerable, but how good do the Cardinals have to be for ownership in the front office to say, we'll augment you now versus the whole message of 2026 being the focus?
What's interesting is you mentioned, you know, what teams look at in terms of how to handle this sort of scenario. It was interesting to hear Lance Lynn talk to Bob Nightingale about, yeah, a lot of teams wanted me to show up in June. Said, well, we're not going to give you $8 million, but we'll give you $4 million if you show up in June, because by then we'll need somebody. Every GM's thinking the same thing, right?
Yeah.
By June, we're going to need somebody. Probably somebody we don't have at AAA, right?
Right.
And so would you, there may be opportunities like that, either from another team that's, you know, in a bail mode, or just, you know, whatever you can do in midseason, because at that point people are looking. So
great point.
Still a vulnerability for this team. And is there anybody who could fill that? You know, Graceffo, you know, he looks the part and he got some of his velocity back, but he had trouble missing bats here when he had his, of course, a lot of people did.
Yeah. I mean, Boston was
a little rough. A lot of balls hitting the wall pretty hard there.
Yeah.
But he looks
as good as the Cardinals have been against the aces here, the four guys that they've hit that no one else has. That's the Red Sox against the Cardinals. They apparently hit the Cardinals and no one else.
Oof. That was a long day.
Mm-hmm.
Long day to park. But no, it's going to be, I think this is a fascinating question. Now we can dovetail that point you made to a beautiful day, a Sunday afternoon. An announced crowd of over a little over 30,000, but it just felt like such a letdown on such a gorgeous day against a good opponent when the team just, you know, has had had some good games recently and nobody, I mean, I wouldn't say nobody comes, but you know, that is, was such a stark contrast to me. That was, that struck me. And Wilson talked about it afterwards. It was a topic to discuss with the skipper. It just, man, it just felt like, oh my, now, what was your reaction to that? And what do you think the DeWitts are thinking?
Yeah. You know what? It's interesting. I'm glad you brought it up. That's actually one of the things I wanted to ask you about is the attendance. Okay. So you're talking about the Philly game where they had 32,509 in the Sunday game, beautiful day. You know, the Phillies also played the Cardinals last April. So you have an apples to apples comparison if you want. Now, mind you, this series, their third home series of the season, was April 11th through the 13th. Last year, it was a full week later in April. Whether or not that matters to you, it matters to the team, because the later in April, the more they tend to sell tickets, which is why the Cardinals don't like to open in April, either because of weather or school or whatever reasons, right? People coming back from spring break, people going on spring break, whatever it is, they feel like if they can open on the road, that gives them home games later in April, and that's what they seek. But they hosted the Phillies in the first nine games of last season. They hosted the Phillies in the first nine games of this season. And, you know, the difference, obviously, the biggest difference is weekday to weekend. This year on a weekend, they were off 2.1% ticket sales from the previous Phillies series. I think, you know, in talking with folks around the Cardinals, they were braced for it to be a lot worse, or not a lot worse, but they were braced for it to be worse. They got a bump because of beautiful weather and because of the Frozen Four. They had 32,000 people show up for the Friday game against the Phillies. And some of that, the big jolt of it that took it into the 30s, or at least got it up into that part of the 30s, was the fact that there were fans from the Frozen Four who stuck around, whose team won in the semifinals. They had Friday night off and before the national championship on Saturday. And so the Cardinals had like a bump in day of or around the day sales that weren't season ticket, all that stuff. Right. And so that helped. The great weather helped. But overall, Jeff, here's a question for you. Which has seen the steeper drop, the Cardinals payroll or the Cardinals ticket sales so far?
Yeah, I don't know how it projects the rest of the year. Obviously, they you
just
know,
right now, we're just doing opening day. So opening day, payroll versus current ticket sales, which has seen the biggest drop.
My guess, it'll ultimately be ticket sales. I'm not sure that's where we're at now.
It is what it is. It's about a 19% drop in payroll from opening day to the next. 26-man roster, not 40-man. So teams set their payroll for 40-man, but that's the 26-man with the injured list. Naturally, a year ago, the Cardinals had a 26-man roster for opening day that did not include Sonny Gray, so I included the injury list in this. That's down, like I said, about 19%. The Cardinals' ticket sales through the first nine games, or tickets sold, they're at 23.6 down. So that's pretty sizable. But the Cardinals were ready for that. They were braced for it. They thought that was a hit. I think the question becomes the one that, like, Wilson sort of touched on. He didn't ask, but at least he, you know, he inspired, is how good do they have to play for the crowds to pick up? And is there any way that this team's play can reinvigorate the fan base? Or, you know, is Twitter right that the fan base is so angry at the ownership or the folks who aren't on the field that they won't show up in the seats?
Well, I think you'll overcome a lot of it. The problem you have with the bad messaging is that we live in an echo chamber world where people who want to wallow in misery and anger can spend all their time there. And so if you spend all your time there, this is all you hear, right? And
a lot of people
in that world.
So no, you're right.
You know, it just, as society is more polarized than ever before, some fan bases can become, radicalized in a negative sense to just, hate everything about their team. I do think that because there are so many, the baseball has been so important to so many people in this town. If this team starts playing or continues to play well, and if you get some breaks with the weather and the right opponent weekend versus weeknight, I think you'll see him overcome some of this. Now, trying to get back, will you ever go back to the question we've asked a couple of times here on the podcast is, will you ever get back to where you could, you know, reasonably anticipate 40,000 people on a Tuesday night at some point?
Not in this economy. Isn't that the phrase?
Exactly. So there's so many things, so many elements, right? And, you know, let's be honest here, man. We're an area that I spend a lot of time at, and it's right on your way. You're walking to the stadium. There's a shootout before a game, you know, gunfire near the stadium, right? You know, not long before a game when people were going to be running around getting ready to go to the game. That's reality. That is an issue that you can't ignore. I'm sure.
Well, that, does. And an incident like that has a magnification issue, right? Like, but it becomes the thing that people go, well, I want to avoid that. I don't want to be there right. The one time it happens. And so you're right. I mean, and I get that pushback a lot. I mean, like I live in the city. I go to the ballpark constantly. It is hard to get past when people latch on to one awful thing that happened. And I think it's fair that people do that. You know, the team has to overcome that then, right? They have to say that's the one day or that's this day, but how do we get people there? General, they've invested a lot in security. They've invested a lot in that. We'll see. They've changed kind of the traffic patterns around. But all of that hasn't reduced ticket prices either. You know, season ticket prices went up. You know, all of that comes into play. And you're exactly right that somebody can latch on to the reason they want to. I'm sorry. It appears to be, and you can push back on that. It appears to me that it's a lot easier to latch on to the reason you don't want to go than it is to come up with the five reasons you want to go to overcome that one reason.
Well, I know. And it's just the world we're in where everything is more dynamic and more dramatic in terms of how the thought process people use, how emotional these things are in these days. It's just the general edginess that you see. It's just the very nature of it. I mean, just all of it. So you take all of it together. You know, this DeWitt's not being really good at messaging, Mo not being the best at messaging, the negative echo chamber complaining. It went from complaining about this team only wants to make the playoffs and then losing the first round to, oh my God, this is really how what other cities go through. This team's not winning. This team had a losing year. Downtown's negative momentum, you know, just there's so many things that combine all together, the economy, soaring prices, things that
the squeezed entertainment dollar. People are making choices with their entertainment dollar coming out of the pandemic. Entertainment was, you know, a click away for some folks, and streaming is all the rage, right? So why leave? And, you know, there's a whole lot, and, you know, just the excess spending money on entertainment. We're just seeing that vanish from our lives, certainly, and from the lives of the people around us. It's just, it's amazing. I mean, you don't look at the movie theaters, look at Broadway, look at all the, I mean, sports is entertainment and they're all seeing the same thing.
Yeah. And I can look at it from my perspective. My son-in-law and my daughter, they would like to go to a lot of games and such, but I can start seeing them again, post-pandemic. They're the demographic that you need to reach if you're a sports team to get them to come out, to bring their kids, to be engaged, to make a day of it. And, you know, I'm just seeing less, just as a tiny sample size and within my own family, like, you know, it's a lot of trouble. I don't know. Prices are high. They got a gigantic TV at home, you know.
Yeah, they've already paid for the subscription.
Video games on sports is fun. You know, I mean, it just, you know, it just the whole battle that baseball has more than any other sport really is with the fans of that demographic. I mean, all of these things roll into one. Mm-hmm. And when the team, now, can a team overcomes all of these different things by playing better? Sure. But how much progress will they make? And then you keep throwing the warning flag because we might as well bum people out all the way, go all the way to the wall on this. What would a work stoppage do? We haven't had one of those in a while.
After
everything else you've gone through, now what if that happens?
Yeah, that's on the horizon after 2026. I wonder if there's something else in play here, Gordo. And, you know, you mentioned it when, and during our conversation, we were talking, you mentioned like Nolan Arenado facing off against Houston has two doubles and a home run. That's the team that wanted to trade for him. You know, he used his no trade clause to say, no, I don't want to go there. Has a great game against them in a way saying like, look, this is the player I can be. There is an element of watching that Astros game from a reporter's perspective going, you know, every time Arenado has a strong stretch, is he also playing for the other teams that he would accept a trade to? Is he also playing his way out of St. Louis? Watching Sonny Gray spin, is there a scenario where he pitches so well and at the trade deadline, you know, even if the Cardinals are above 500, hovering around 500, slightly below 500, you know, just out of the division race, slightly in it, whatever, where a team that he would accept a trade to comes calling and he's pitching great and he's pitched his way out of St. Louis. Certainly there's a scenario where Eric Fetty, Ryan Helsley have pitched their way out of St. Louis. And I watched that through a reporter's lens about like, okay, that's going to be a story that you watch unfold and possibly have to tell. But from a fan perspective, I could see how, like, why would I want to go and watch a guy who the team is just hoping performs so they can trade him? Why would I go watch a team that I know no matter how good it plays, it's going to be dismantled? That I think, I don't think that's a small part of this. If you're a fan and you're going to watch the Cardinals and you go and see the lineup perform like it has through the first stretch here, or you go and see an entertaining game like Sunday's game under the sun, don't you in the back of your mind watch it and go, how good does this team have to be for it not to be dismantled? And for more than two decades, that's never been a thought. You never go to Busch Stadium and wonder, is the team I see in April going to be stripped for parts by August? No, you go and you watch. This is the team that we're going to go through 6 months for. This is the team we're going to watch. This is the team we're going to see. And they're going to add pieces, either youth coming up or trades happen. But this is the group. And this might be the first season in a long time, Jeff, where fans go and they're like, well, this may not be the team that we get to stick through.
Yeah, this is the bad part about having two decades of perennial contention is that fans just assume that's what you'll always have, and that they take it for granted to a degree. It's the expectation. It's the expectation the organization had too, and the ownership had. But you know, it was an unrealistic overperformance by a mid-market team that led to an unrealistic overperformance by a fan base showing up. Now we see the reality of what usually happens in a mid-sized market, where it becomes more cyclical. What we've talked about. And so the fan support may become more cyclical versus constant. So all of this is unfamiliar to the best fans in baseball because they haven't been in this place except go back to the 90s, which were a bit of a mess between Whitey Ball and McGuire Mania, and go back to the 70s before that when you could hear crickets in August at some of these games. So yeah. It's all of this is fascinating because the players – Sonny Gray and Nolan Arenado, they came here because of the 40,000 on Tuesday night, the vibe.
Right,
this was
right.
Unique. Now they look up and say, it's not the same. The fans are saying, it's not the same. The players are saying, it's not the same. And the owners are like, yeah, it's not the same for at least this year. What you normally do if you're a team is sell the future, which is how teams go through the cyclical process that they do in baseball, is that they're always circling back and selling the future and hoping that it works out. In this market size, this is not Chicago. This is not Houston. It's going to be a little different.
Yeah. I'm going to lean on something that scouts think about. And that's, you know, you go to a game and you see a young guy, a young player who may not have like the best numbers and everything like that. But he goes out there and all of a sudden has like just puts his game together the one time the scout is there. And there, you know, there's a double off the wall and two homers over it. There's a series of really athletic, nimble plays at shortstop. And the scout goes, well, it It's not there every day, but it's in there somewhere. So how do you get it out? And I'm not so quick to dismiss the fact that the Cardinals somehow defied the odds for 20 years, because it's in there somewhere. That fan base wants to support it somehow, some way. It was there. And it's too easy to go, well, it was because of Albert Pujols or it was Yadier Molina. Those are big parts of it for sure. Absolutely. But so too was the experience of going to a game, the style, the panache, the community, you know, swagger of being a small market team, acting like a big market team. It was there. So it's a matter of how to get that back. You know, you gotta act like a big market team, and maybe that galvanizes fans to say, well, we're a big market baseball club. We might not be a big market population, but when it comes to baseball, finish third, finish second in attendance and tickets sold, we'll outpace the market, because the team has a swagger and a brand and a notion of outpacing the market.
Yeah, this was a relationship, and I don't know that the relationship has been broken. This is like a long marriage that had, there was a lot of a trust back and forth. This was special. It, you know, the relationship with the fans and the team was special. This wasn't just people going to a ball game. This was a relationship fans had with the sport and with the team. And, you know, everybody has anecdotal evidence, people they know, people that, you know, like a friend of mine had partial season tickets. His wife's a Maniac fan. His kid's a Maniac fan. His daughter's Maniac fans. Grandkids, Maniac fans. They're all in. They absorb everything. They watch everything. They consume lots and lots of information. But this year, they're like, as far as actually going. Now, their relationship is still there, but it needs to be rekindled. They're taking they're taking a little time off in the relationship. Doesn't mean that it's broken. I don't think there's been a betrayal, maybe a disappointment. But this is like, even last year, the Cardinals, they had one bad year. Last year, one of the most improved teams in the league. They conceivably had a chance to contend, but just fell flat after they made some additions to the trade deadline. It was unfortunate. A lot of things went wrong last year, but that team wasn't far off from at least being an NL Central contender. Same can be said this year. This is not terrible. This is not like a betrayal. You know, this is not my Tigers, what my Tigers did to its fan base over the years. Now the Tigers are pretty good. How many years are they the Baltimore Orioles, a great city, a great town, a great baseball town, just outright betrayal. I mean, just betraying him and then just kicking him when they're down to fans and just dumping on the fans and saying stupid things about the fans, just over and over for years. That has not happened here.
So yeah,
there's hope.
I like the way you put that, Gordo. That is Jeff Gordon, St. Louis Post-Dispatch, sports columnist, stltoday.com, instant offense there with Tip Sheet. You can find all of his work there and in the pages of the Post-Dispatch. That's also where you can find all the constant Cardinals coverage. I'm off to Queens this week and then on to Atlanta for another road trip with the Cardinals. They then return home with a four-game series in Cincinnati, also on the horizon towards the end of the month. So they're hit their stretch without really an off day, where they have to go into this six-man rotation, Jeff, and we'll be there tracking, and we'll see if the lineup can keep the pressure on and if the pitching can support it, and if they kind of just hover around 500. But if they play a more entertaining brand of baseball than the past 2 years where they've hovered around 500, I think that's something to watch too.
Well, I know we need to pump some more sunshine here. We'll take it upon ourselves, Derek.
Regardless, I have to use a lot of active verbs. Really, regardless of the result of the game, I have to write entertaining stories. That's
the goal,
right? And entertaining podcasts. Thank you so much for joining me, Gordo. You can find the best podcast in baseball wherever you get your podcasts. That includes, well, Apple, iTunes. You can just have it right there sent to your phone. Please rate and review the podcast, because the reviews help us know how we're doing. And also, we get to hear back from the community about what you want us to do. Subscriptions make the podcast possible, because subscriptions make sponsorships possible. Gordo, thank you for this conversation. It was great. We got through Brant Brown's lingo. We got through six-man rotation, and we touched on the biggest question of them all is how to reinvigorate, reanimate this fan base. I think you put it well. You know, it hasn't been a rupture of trust, but some mending needs to be done. And it's so fascinating to me that the rupture has taken place with the front office, but it's up to the players then to mend it. That's kind of fitting, I guess.
It's show business. And but I love the fact that players are, you know, they get it. And they know it's their job to put out a good product. And, man, they're giving it a go.
They certainly are aware of it. For Jeff Gordon, I'm St. Louis Post-Dispatch baseball writer Derek Gould. Talk to you soon.
That's a professional job.
If your job at a healthcare facility includes disinfecting against viruses, you know prevention is the best medicine. And maintaining healthy spaces starts with a healthy cleaning routine. Grainger's world-class supply chain helps ensure you have the quality products you need when you need them. From disinfectants and cleaning supplies to personal protective equipment, so you can help deliver a clean bill of health. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.